And welcome back to Dad's on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Dr. Peter Cochran, who is the author of a new book called Best We Forget: The War for White Australia, 1914 to 1918. Peter Cochran's writing about war includes the award-winning Simpson and the Donkey, The Making of a Legend, the companion volume to the ABC TV series Australians at War, and two studies of wartime photography, The Western Front 1916 to 18 and Tobruk 1941. His books in other fields of history include Colonial Ambition, Foundations of Australian Democracy, which won the Age Book of the Year Award and the Prime Minister's Prize for Australian History. Peter, welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Thanks so much, Bill. Good to be here.
So, Peter, the title for your book is Best We Forget.
Yes.
Is that somewhat ironic?
That's absolutely ironic. And I made very, very sure in the last paragraph of the book, actually, that said something along the lines of just that. It is ironic, and we should be sure to remember the sacrifices that our soldiers made, the battles that have taken such an important part in our national memory, I guess, and, you know, subsequently the efforts to support them, legacy and whatever else along the way.
Yes, well, you've managed to link Anzac Day and the White Australia policy, so this is going to be revealing and probably unsettling to many people. Was that part of your intention in writing the book?
Well, I suppose the answer is yes or no. The way the book came about was, I've been teaching history at Sydney University for quite a while, and subsequently I've been freelance writing. And in the course of those many years, I became aware of books that was a select number of books, all in all I'd say about 20, most of them scholarly books, i.e. academic books, not for the general reader, that when you consider them all together, added up to a story that isn't very well known by the general public, but that's exceptionally important if we want to understand World War One. The first of those was way back, was Humphrey McQueen's A New Britannia in 1970, and then there's, as I say, quite a few just piecemeal came out over the years. The most recent one was the wonderful biography of C.W. Bean, the official war historian, by Peter Rees, which came out in late 2016. And collectively, what really hit me when I was just rereading one in particular of those books by Neville Meaney called The Search for Security in the Pacific, what hit me was just what an important part was race fear in the preparation for the war and the war itself. What the book is trying to do is bring together all that and make it possible for and readable for a general readership. I mean, the book is essentially about the way in which race fear of Japan and distrust of Britain, Japan's very close ally, played a major part in the foreign policy and defence thinking of our national leaders before the war, before World War One, during the war, and in the peace negotiation at Versailles thereafter. So even though the subtitle is The War for White Australia, 1914 to 18, there's quite a run-up to that. There's a number of chapters that cover the period roughly about roughly from the 1880s right through to the war, focusing on the fear of Japan the fear of Asia and the fear of Japan in particular. There's a chapter, for example, on White Australia called Chapter 3 is The Declaration of White Australia. And I thought it was very important to explain just how central to Australian thinking the necessity for race purity in this country had become, because, as we know, the Immigration Restriction Act was one of the first pieces of legislation debated in the new Parliament, the new Commonwealth Parliament, in 1901. And that is a really, really fascinating debate. And what comes out of this is the clear sense that there was pretty much a consensus around this idea that race purity was absolutely crucial for all of the high ideals and ambitions associated with federation and the new nation. And the other side of that coin, of course, was the fear of racial dilution was the language, was the phrase that was often used. The fear that if we did mix culturally, and even worse, if we were to interbreed, and I'm using the language of the times, then it'd be a downhill slope all the way. But the only, that in other words, white Australia and race purity was a prerequisite. It was, you know, the thing you had to have before before anything else for the high ideals of the new Commonwealth. And then as Japan, it's interesting that at the same time as the white Australia legislation was being debated in Australia, late in 1901, at the very same time, Britain was negotiating its military alliance with Japan, which was to last for more than 20 years, secretly. So Australia, a member of the, you know, an important dominion, a member of the British Empire, was debating white Australia, putting it in place, and the debates very much disturbed the Japanese, I can tell you, because they had a consul in Sydney who regularly travelled to Melbourne for the parliamentary discussions, and they had a minister in London as well who were constantly reporting what was being said. So it was precisely the time that some terrible things were being said, at least in our terms, 2018, some terrible, shocking things were being said about Asians and about the Japanese. The British were secretly negotiating an alliance with the Japanese that would confirm to the world that they had arrived. They were now a military power on par with the European powers. They were the most significant naval force in the Pacific, and indeed the reason that the Brits wanted that alliance was precisely so that it put more military emphasis on the North Sea and the defence of Britain itself against, you know, other European powers, and in a sense contract out the security of the Pacific to the Japanese. Now the Australian government and, well, the Australian Parliament, almost to a man, and they were, was all men, was very, very disturbed by this, and really that remained the same. And one of the big worries was this idea of interbreeding, that what always happens, the argument went, and this was a real pseudo-scientific notion, was that the lower will bring down the higher. If the white race mixes with the coloured races, as they were called, then the lower, the coloured races, will bring down the higher. So all those anxieties were in play, you know, yet again leading up to federation. And indeed, in the 1890s, the colonies on the East Coast were legislating along the lines of what eventually became, you know, the national legislation. They were, New South Wales, for example, was bringing in, I think it was 1996, its own, in effect, white Australia legislation.
And we're speaking today with Dr. Peter Cochrane, who is the author of a new book called Best We Forget, The War for White Australia, 1914 to 1918. We might just take a short break there and play some music from the period. This is Roses of Picardy by Richard Tauber.
Tis a rose. years fly on forever. He's a shadow in the skies, but he loves to hold her little hands and look in her sea blue eyes. And she sees the road by the poplars where they met in the bygone years. For the first little song of the roses is a last little song she hears. Roses are shining in victory in the heart of the sea for you. Roses are flowering in Picardy, but there's never a rose like you. And roses will die with the summertime, and our old may be far apart, but there's one rose that dies and not in Picardy.
And that was Roses of Picardy by Richard Tauber. And we're speaking today with Dr. Peter Cochran, who is the author of Best We Forget. So, Peter, yes, I must admit, I've always wondered, and I'm sure the French people wonder, why a small country on the other side of the world would come and send their best young men to fight and die for them. I think you've explained very eloquently what some of the real reasons were, and it's not what we're taught in history at school.
Yes, but I think it's a bit of both. I mean, there's no doubt, I'm not wanting to argue that Australia went to war primarily because of its concerns about Japan or distrust of Britain. What I want to say is that in addition to what was clearly in 1914 a commitment to defend the empire, a commitment by Australia to defend the empire against Germany and Germany's allies, is part of the story. And it's that term ambivalent. I mean, and I think at the popular level, that was the primary understanding. But at the foreign policy, or at the political level, when you begin to look into the foreign policy and the diplomacy, much of which, of course, was secret at the time, you see that there was another huge concern. That was this idea that Billy Hughes, I think, best encapsulated, that a mighty blood sacrifice had to be made by Australia to ensure that at the bargaining table, whenever the war ended, Australia would have enough chips on the table, would have enough credits, as it were, to keep white Australia safe. And in the course of the war, Hughes went, soon after he became Prime Minister in late 1915, he went to Britain for many reasons. There were many problems prosecuting the war, but one of the, pretty close to the top of his agenda with this was this deep concern about Japan's leverage in London, and also a concern about the possibility that if the war went really badly, Japan might change sides and shift over to Germany. So on both those counts, there was Hughes was really very, very anxious. And whilst he was in London, as we now know, because one of those books I mentioned earlier, the biography of Billy Hughes by Laurie Fitzharding, we know quite clearly that he was there trying to shore up Australia's credits, if you like, at the centre of the empire for when the bargaining did begin. I mean, he was pretty convinced that at the end of the war, the Japanese would be wanting access to Australia in one form or another, and they'd be wanting equal trade relations. They'd be wanting some undoing of the White Australia legislation, and he was quite emphatic about never giving an inch on that particular front. And he said in a big town hall meeting just before the first conscription referendum, which is perhaps something we should talk about because race comes into that in a big way too. He actually said, appealing to the men who had not yet gone to fight, I bid you go to France and fight for white Australia. He made it very clear what he was on about. His big problem was that the last thing the British wanted was for any criticism of the Japanese to be made public. And so it was a real irony, because his War Precautions Act, which was a really draconian piece of legislation, actually forbade Australians from criticising the Japanese publicly. which was simply required by the British war effort. But at the same time, Hughes had this view that people had to be made aware that there was, apart from the German menace, there was this other danger hovering in the wings. It was as perilous a matter for Australia as was Germany.
Well, Billy Hughes, I think he was the quintessential fighting above his weight, both physically and for a small country. But he was actually a thorn in the side in the major powers negotiations at Versailles, wasn't he?
Well, he was. He caused more trouble there for the British than any other political leader, I think. I mean, his real concern was... He had a number of concerns. One was how the Pacific would be divided up. Having the wars over, the spoils were to be shared out by the victors. And he was really for, I guess, what you'd call a brutal peace. He wanted Germany not only to pay for the damage done in Europe, but for all the costs of war. And there was a view in amongst the Entente powers, Britain in particular, that they just couldn't go that far. They'd ruin the world economy. And that partly the concern was, how do we rebuild a viable international economy? But Billy Hughes wasn't too concerned about that. He was extremely nationalist in his approach. His main concern, actually, was the South Pacific. He wanted to be assured that in dividing up the German possessions, Australia or Britain, i.e. a friendly power, would be in charge south of the equator. And he basically got what he wanted. I mean, the Japanese did get to keep the islands, the Carolines and the Marshall Islands that they'd seized from Germany earlier in the war, north of the equator. And the Germans were, of course, removed from the possessions they held south of the equator, and the British and the Australians took over there. And his other concern was racial equality, as the Japanese did submit a racial equality clause to the Versailles Conference, and they were very confident it would be passed. They'd seen themselves for many years. Remember that the military alliance with Japan began in 1902, and it has to be said they had been good allies. Japanese warship was among the escort that conveyed the first AIF to the Middle East, the Ibuki. So they'd been good allies, and they did have a bit of leverage at the bargaining table, and they were very keen to have this racial equality clause passed at the conference. And Hughes led the fight against that. I think it's true to say that the European powers were half-hearted, but Britain probably would have supported it, I think, had they not had this opposition from the Dominions led by Hughes. And of course, the other thing that we might talk about is conscription, because there the fear of Japan was actually a major part of the debate in both the first referendum and the second.
Well, yes, Hughes lost those referendums, but it was odd that the racism card was being put up on both sides, the yes and the no case in that.
Yes, that's exactly right. And all the more odd because, as I mentioned before, the War Precautions Act was actually outlawed any talk about certainly the Japanese race, but people didn't seem to be too worried about that. On the yes side, where they were more cautious about vilifying an ally, there was the argument that it was Lloyd George's argument that what we have to have is the one big blow, the one huge war effort that will smash the enemy, and therefore we need every man we can possibly gather for that. We need conscription, in other words, if possible, to push that argument without saying too much about race. But the dimension where race came in was that some of the advocates of yes for conscription were talking about what they called white fratricide. They characterised the war in Europe as the white races destroying one another. And there were some rather chilling comments made about how in Melbourne Punch, for example, the coloured races are watching and waiting with a grin on their face. Comments like that, just enjoying seeing the white races destroy themselves. Of course, this was very wrong. I mean, there's plenty of scholarship in more recent times has made clear just how many millions of non-white peoples in the colonial world were shanghaied or harnessed not into the war effort on both sides. Really was terribly misleading to be talking about the war as white fratricide, you know, white brothers killing one another, because so many non-white peoples were kind of swept up into the fight in one way or another. The obvious one, of course, that we it took professional historians 50 years to actually notice that there was a racial dimension to the, a big racial dimension to the conscription debate. And as you said, the antis, who felt far less inclined to be obedient to the War Precautions Act, were very happy to, at least some of them were, not all of them, but pretty much all of them were happy to talk about the race dimension. For example, one of the, if not Japan, because so one of the arguments of the no voters in the conscription referendum was that it would denude the male labour force, that you're sending all these men off, they're going to be killed, wounded, many of them are going to be killed or wounded. You're going to run down the male, the white male labour force in Australia, and what the capitalists will then do is bring in cheap labour. That the war, the destruction of very trade unionised labour movement in Australia was actually going to suit the empire capitalists operating in Australia. So there was that sort of class dimension to the race scare. And the other part of it was, of course, the politicians and the otherwise the campaigners who spoke specifically about the Japanese, actually who actually defied the War Precautions Act and said, I'm sorry, we just don't care. We want to get this message out. The real danger to Australia is the real looming danger, or if you like, the long-term danger, is actually the Japanese. There's one MP, Labour MP, in the Commonwealth Parliament. He was a New South Welshman called J.H. Katz, and he was charged seven times for violating, or prosecuted, I should say, seven times for violating the War Precautions Act and talking bluntly about what he called, you know, the Japanese danger to Australia, and calling it racial suicide. And he spoke at some length in the Parliament on that too.
And yet all this is focusing outside Australia. I mean, it's ignoring the indigenous population, which is, doesn't seem to figure at all in these discussions.
No, that's right. That's right. Although it's interesting that you say that, because it just doesn't come into the discussion much at all. But Keith Murdoch, who is very Rupert's father, who has really made his name in World War One with his famous Gallipoli letter, and who was very close to Billy Hughes, he was a bit of a sort of key minder and certainly a key media manager and spin doctor for Billy Hughes. He made many of the same points again and again about the fear of the Japanese. At one point in the war, I just can't recollect when it was, I think it was late 1916, he said in a letter that things were not going well on the Western Front, and he wished the Aboriginal people could, or the Aboriginal manhood could be Prussianised. And what he meant by that was they could be forcibly rounded up, put into uniforms and made to fight. Which might be, might be an indication of just how desperate he was feeling about the way the war was going. I don't think the Aboriginal people came into the thinking in this racial story at all. It was much more about the what, as I've said, the white race at war, the fear of the Japanese, will they change sides, what will happen at the end of the war, that, you know, and can this go on? Can we continue to have an Australia, a white Australia, which is actually protected by a nation whom we exclude totally from our domestic scene?
And our guest today is Dr. Peter Cochran. Peter, this is a fascinating topic, but we've reached a stage of the show, we ask our guests to pick a song for us or some music. Would you like to select one for us?
Yeah, well, I have to tell you, Bill, this was quite a challenge, because when I made a little list, I just didn't know what to do. I had some rock music I would have perhaps chosen. I had some really ancient pop stuff that I love. In the end, I decided Gabriel's Oboe, which is it is the opening portion of Ennio Morricone's beautiful, beautiful music that accompanies the film The Mission. The scene in which we hear a little bit of Gabriel's Oboe played in a rather amateurish way, it has Jeremy Lyons, the great British actor, in a jungle scene in the Amazon, and he knows that the eyes of the local people are upon him. He can't see them, but he knows he's being watched. He's a Jesuit missionary, and so he gets out this little oboe, like it's more like a flute, I think, what he plays, and plays this beautiful riff in the actual film. Gabriel being the priest, Gabriel's oboe, as it should be played. And I find it so moving, it brings tears to my eyes just about every time I listen to it.
And that was Gabriel's oboe from The Mission, as chosen for us today by our guest, Dr. Peter Cochran. Peter, it just remains for me now to thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Bill, but I think we managed.
We did. It was great talking to you. And
great talking to you too.
Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.